possible by the U of I Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2005 lecture series presents Otherworldly and Thisworldly Piety and the Islamic Revival by Francis Robinson, Professor of History at the University of London, on Monday, January 31st at 4 p.m. at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in. On the program today, we take a look at the editorial cartoon in the American press. The editorial cartoon gives us an opportunity to see ourselves afresh. The political commentary is barbed. The jab is felt within seconds. Political cartoonists reveal our foibles and those of our leaders. Our guest this afternoon is Chris Lamb, an associate professor of communication at the College of Charleston. He is the author of Drawn to Extremes, The Use and Abuse of Editorial Cartoons. Chris Lamb's interest in editorial cartooning goes back at least 20 years. In the early 1980s, it was the subject of his master's thesis. Today, Lamb sees the art in decline. He says most newspapers today publish relatively generic, gag-based syndicated cartoons, mainly because they are cheaper and generate fewer complaints from readers. If this is the case, will it diminish our political discourse? What might we lose? And what does this tell us about the future of the newspaper? Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion. What questions and comments do you have about editorial cartooning? Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Chris Lamb has written articles on editorial cartooning for several publications, including the Chicago Tribune, the Miami Herald, and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. His book, Drawn to Extremes, The Use and Abuse of Editorial Cartoons, is published by Columbia University Press. Join the discussion. Here are the numbers once again. 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Chris Lamb, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Good afternoon, Celeste. It's very nice to be here.
You open this book, Drawn to Extremes, with an anecdote that illustrates the heat that editorial cartoons can generate from readers. The story involves a cartoon drawn by Joel Pett of the Lexington, Kentucky Herald Leader. Would you tell us the story?
Yes. A few days after the 9/11 attacks, President Bush said that he would punish any state that harbored terrorists. And Pett thought, well, since the terrorists took flying lessons in Florida, he wondered if the president had plans to attack Florida. Mm-hmm. And in the days or months or even years after September 11th, people's sensibilities are rather affected. And in Pett's answering machine voicemail was packed with messages. He said the most poignant was one from what appeared to be an elderly woman who screamed at him and said, yeah, you should have been at the Washington Trade Center the World Trade Center on September 11th. And Pat's reaction was, wow, you know, this sort of really sums up the kind of reaction that we get with our cartoons.
Yeah. Readers of newspapers have long delighted or been outraged by political cartoons. A couple of questions here. Do you think our collective skin has gotten thinner, or are we just from time to time, in a time of attack, of war, for example, more sensitive, less open to the criticism leveled by cartoonists?
I think it's more the second. This country through history has had not a very good tradition of abandoning civil liberties during the times when we need them the most. And we get very, very, and during these times, there is this tendency, and I don't think it's necessarily a positive one, to rally behind the leaders no matter what they do. It's our country, right or wrong. I'm not sure it's a productive wisdom for a democracy. I think we always need to remember that what makes us America and what makes us different from other countries is the fact that we should always have free expression.
Yeah.
And I think during times like this, we need them the most.
Yeah. Although cartoonists can be sensitive to the time as well. After September 11th, one cartoonist that you mentioned in the book, Steve Breen, drew a bald eagle sharpening its talons, and he described it as more a cheerleading cartoon than an editorial cartoon. So this also affects cartoonists and what they draw.
Oh, I think September 11th, if it didn't have an effect on you, you are a cold human being.
Yeah.
And there was nothing wrong with in the day or two or maybe even three, because I think all cartoonists, they're human beings first, although maybe politicians might argue with that. and most cartoonists, you know, did cartoons of the nature of Mike Lukovich, which I think his cartoon of the Statue of Liberty with the airplanes and the vision of the airplanes in the eyes of the Statue of Liberty is one that's hard to forget. And I just think there were cartoons for two or three days afterwards that were of sort of what you mentioned about Steve Breen.
Yeah.
Whether they were these incredibly gut-wrenching emotional cartoons or they were the let's go get 'em cartoons.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Chris Lamb, our guest this afternoon. We're talking about editorial cartooning. We have a listener waiting to talk with us. Let's go and talk with our caller this afternoon who's on line 4 listening in Indiana. Good afternoon.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Just from what you've been talking about, I presume your book is about more recent political cartoons. When I first heard what she was having on the show, came up something I remember probably got from grade school or maybe junior high school textbook. It was in there, and I think it had to do with Andrew Jackson, but I could be wrong, but it was some presidential thing, and somebody was carrying around presumably his bastard child. And I know that the early political cartoons were, you know, I don't know what the exact adjective I should use, but they sure are more than what we have now with more of a generic thing. The one that pops in my mind is Abe Lincoln crying after Kennedy's assassination. And I just wondered if you could give a date, sort of like when you commence your study of the political cartoons in your book. Thanks.
There are a couple chapters that are very recent, and a couple of chapters I deal more with the history. You mentioned the Bill Malden cartoon, which is one of the most famous cartoons of all time, which is the Abe Lincoln in the Lincoln Memorial crying, his head's bowed after the assassination of President Kennedy, and there's probably been no more poignant cartoon. And in many ways, the cartoons that we mention after September 11th are sort of based on the Malden model. The Jackson, and you're absolutely right. We think that politics is awful now, and I'm not disagreeing that. But early cartoons portrayed George Washington, for instance, as a jackass, and so it does go back all the way to the beginning of the country. I think editorial cartoons are as American as the First Amendment and as irreverent as the Boston Tea Party.
Hmm. Last Friday in the New York Times, there was an article on an exhibition of cartooning by an English satirist by the name of James Gilray, and he lived from 1756 to 1815. This was an article appearing Friday, January 7th, 2005. And in this article, accompanying the article, three cartoons, James Gilray did fine work. I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but one of the cartoons depicts King George III as Jonathan Swift's king, peering at Napoleon as Gulliver to poke fun at the threat of a French invasion. And here the king is holding Gulliver in the palm of his hand and looking through, an eyepiece. And, you know, it's a wonderful cartoon, and it works today. But one of the things I would like to talk about, since the caller raised the issue of history, what do our cartoonists today owe the satirists who went before them?
Well, we should stand on the shoulders of the giants who came before us, and with cartooning, it goes back to Thomas Nast, who drew in the 1860s and 70s and 80s. He's sort of the father of American cartooning. The first caller from Indiana mentioned the Andrew Jackson cartoons. That predates Thomas Nast. But Thomas Nast, I think, was the first cartoonist who really flexed his muscles and showed how powerful a cartoon could be. And his nemesis was Boss Tweed, was William Mercy Tweed, who then was one of the leaders of the corrupt Tammany Hall machine in New York City politics. And he stayed after Boss Tweed for week after week, month after month, and eventually was credited with Tweed going to jail. And I think just as what Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein did with the Watergate investigation, the Richard Nixon administration, Thomas Nast did with Boss Tweed.
Yeah. When did editorial cartoons begin appearing as a staple in newspapers?
In daily newspapers, there was always this idea that, first of all, it needed a technology. We needed to be able to publish something more than one column, and the technology made it possible, but they're also, in probably the mid-19th century, but editors still had to be convinced. Editors are a conservative, tentative bunch, and they needed to be convinced that that cartoons could work. And the big cartoon there was Joseph Pulitzer's New York World, where he did a cartoon right before the presidential election of 1884, where it was called Belshazzar, Blaine and the Money Kings, and he borrowed from biblical allegory. And he showed James Blaine, who was running for president, as this plutocrat who was feeding all the rich people of New York City while the poor were starving, and that cartoon came out just before the election, and Pulitzer ran it across the whole front page, and it was distributed, and Blaine barely lost, and the thinking was that if Blaine had won New York State, he would have won the election, so people surmise that maybe the cartoon may help decide the election. And from that point on, editors realized that a cartoonist is worth our money. And that sort of brought about the first golden age of editorial cartooning, where you saw hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, even thousands of editorial cartoonists working for daily newspapers across America.
Mm. Cartooning has been strong in the U.S. and Britain. Has it flourished in other countries?
Oh, yes, yes. I'm more of an American press historian, but sure. I mean, I would advise your callers to get on politicalcartoons.com, and it has cartoonists from all over the world. And you see a very different approach after 9/11. We see our cartoons, for the most part, tend to be very supportive of Uncle Sam and the Bush administration, although that seems to be changing. In foreign countries, they were more critical pretty much, let's say, after 3 days after September 11th. They weren't saying that, you know, we had it coming, but they were critical of our foreign policy.
And that's also what happened with Joel Pett, that cartoon that we talked about earlier.
Yeah, you can always measure the effectiveness of a cartoon one way, is in the reaction of the subject. If you can get a, if you can get somebody really upset, I mean, our current president is incredibly sensitive to criticism, and his father sort of set the standard of sensitivity, and he would just get so unwound by a Doonesbury. And he would interrupt the first President Bush would interrupt his own speeches and lash out at Doonesbury, and he would say that he wanted a challenge. He would basically call Trudeau out for, you know, let's duke it out in the streets, and he would say he wanted to kick Trudeau's butt across New England. And one time the Oakland Tribune editorialized by saying President Bush needs to quit reading Doonesbury and taking it so seriously.
Yeah, right.
So the best thing to do is ignore it, because we're all cartoonists are just like kids were in the fourth or fifth grade. If you start teasing somebody and they get upset, well, you're going to keep being teased.
Yeah. And one of the chapters in the book deals with the responsive subjects of cartoons, and it's titled "President Bush has been reading Doonesbury and taking it much too seriously," and he's not the only one either. I mean, politicians are not the only folks who get all flabbergasted and undone, unwound by being taken apart in a cartoon.
Well, they're not used to having people question them, and they're certainly not used to having people portray them as idiots. I think what the value of editorial cartooning is it forces us to is we see ourselves not as we want to be seen, but as we are. And that's not always pleasant.
Mm. Chris Lamb is our guest this afternoon here in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's an associate professor of communication at the College of Charleston and the author of Drawn to Extremes, The Use and Abuse of Editorial Cartoons. Editorial cartooning, our subject this afternoon in this portion of the program. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon, join the discussion. What questions and comments do you have about editorial cartooning? Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And we have a listener joining us now from Urbana on line one.
Hi,
hello.
Thanks. I wanted to ask you about two different cartoons. One that's very controversial in our local paper right now, Boondocks by Aaron Magruder. And I was also curious your comments about Tom Tomorrow's cartoon.
Okay, I may not know these specifically. I'm familiar with both the people you mentioned, but maybe not the cartoons. That a Boondocks is first of all, we have through history there are very few African American cartoonists working for daily newspapers, or women for that matter. And Aaron Magruder sort of came out of this, and he's become very influential. And we mentioned a Bush cartoon that got him into some trouble, where the Bush administration came up with this TIPS program, where the Justice Department or the FBI wanted us to call and rat out our fellow citizens who might be up to no good, and anybody who might have any ties to terrorists. And he has one of the characters in Boondocks calling up the FBI and saying, I have a name of somebody who contributed to Osama bin Laden, and he spells out the name Reagan, and the person hangs up. And so that's just an example of an Aaron Magruder cartoon. But I don't see him terribly often. I certainly see him as being a strong-minded cartoonist. And then Tom Tomorrow, who you mentioned, is also sort of in the alternative. He's sort of an alternative cartoonist as well. He's a little wordy for me. I tend to like single panels and fewer words. But I think he's very well thought of.
Yeah. Well, the caller alluded to the controversy here in our local paper. The cartoons have been, as they are, no doubt everywhere. The cartoons, you know, are a source of debate. And in the Champaign-Urbana paper recently, the News-Gazette, we've had criticism from the left about a strip, Mallard Fillmore.
Okay.
And we've had criticism from the right about Boondocks and Non Sequitur. Mallard is gone, but before the strip was pulled completely, it was put on the editorial page. And Boondocks was pulled for a while, but then people complained, and it returned to the paper, but it's in the back of the paper. It's in the classified section. What would you like to say about how newspapers deal with controversial strips?
Oh, I just think newspapers deal with controversial strips as poorly as they possibly could. If you were to get together the expert minds in America and say, how could we really screw something up? And you gave them the time and the money, and they would put together a plan. I'm not sure newspapers, I think newspapers can one-up the best minds in America on this. One of the problems with newspapers is they don't like to answer phones. Editors did not get to be editors by being daring and controversial and cutting edge. Cutting edge for an editor is having raisins on their oatmeal. They don't like phones to ring, and they don't like people to complain. Now for you and for any other business, a phone call is a good thing. It means people are out there. It means people are interested. And to me, that would, if the people are calling up, whether they're happy with a cartoon or whether they're angry, it means they're reading it. It means they're reacting to it. It means they're buying the newspaper. And I just think I think newspapers should put cartoons on page one.
Hmm. What can you tell us about the relationship between editors and cartoonists?
Oh, in the best situation, it's pretty good. The best cartoonists usually have editors who, if they don't understand them, at least they give them the freedom to do their best work. Editors and cartoonists come at it from different directions. I mean, reporters grow up to be editors and cartoonists grow up to be old cartoonists. So that, you know, and editors like things to be fairly objective and literal and straightforward and supported by the facts and all this sort of things. And cartoonists just want to use hyperbole and exaggeration. So their approaches are quite different. And yet, you know, the editors, the best cartoonists have pretty good editors. It boggles me that in most newspapers, letters to the editor, someone who writes a letter to the editor is given more freedom than the person drawing the editorial cartoon.
Hmm.
Editors sort of see cartoonists, they should be illustrating their editorials, and it's one of the problems is editors really don't understand the job of cartoonists.
Yeah. There is an interesting cartoon, one of the many cartoons that you have in the book, of a cartoonist seeing himself, seeing the editor in a certain straight-laced kind of way. He draws him in one panel, and then he draws himself as how the editor sees him, and then he draws himself as how he sees himself. And then in the end, he sees himself as the editor.
Yeah, I think we all see it ourselves as the virtuous prince writing in, and I'm not sure that's how other people see us. Part of this is that humor as an art form is devalued in America. E.B. White once said that we reward our serious writers with laurels and our wits with Brussels sprouts. And I think there's this feeling if something is funny, it can't be serious. And yet, I think editorial cartoonists are the most serious thing and the most serious thing in the newspaper.
Yeah. I'm going to look here, I'm going to dive into the book and share with listeners something that you share in the pages of the book, Drawn to Extremes, from Jeff McNally. You quote him as saying, cartoonists violate every rule of ethical journalism. They misquote, trifle with the truth, make science fiction out of politics, and sometimes should be held for personal libel. But when the smoke clears, the cartoonist has been getting closer to the truth than the guys who write political opinion.
Yeah. It's kind of a it's the difference between something figurative and something literal, I suppose.
Yeah.
In some ways, if you look at, you know, great satire in history, A Modest Proposal is this terrific piece, you know, written 300 or 400 years ago, on where Jonathan Swift writes about, okay, what do we do about the problem of the poor and impoverished in Ireland, and his modest proposal is we eat our young. Well, you know, no one was supposed to take that literally, and yet what he's doing is he's saying that the king and the folks running Ireland are an idea that they might actually, in their cold-hearted indifference, that's what they might as well be saying.
Hmm. So being outrageous is a way to get us to pay attention very quickly, and then by, you know, as McNally put it, trifling with the truth, we get to the truth.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, I think you can't. The example I was once given by Mike Peters was that, you know, you can, when we were talking during the Reagan administration, he said, now, if I show Ronald Reagan reaching into a baby carriage or reaching into a child's lunchbox and taking food out, literally that's not true. President Reagan, as far as we know, has never actually robbed a child of their food. However, but if taken in the context of cutting school lunch programs, the cartoon works.
Mm-hmm. Well, you spend a little time in the book, Drawn to Extremes, talking about the techniques of satirists, and one of the basic techniques, reduction.
Right.
This would be a good time, I think, to talk a little bit about the basic elements of successful satire. What makes it work? What makes an editorial cartoon work?
Well, a few things. You know, one of them certainly is reduction. You reduce somebody to an animal, and you keep reducing them to different forms of animals. If to draw somebody as a dog or as a snake or as something like that, we've reduced, they're no longer human beings. That would be one technique. Another technique is in the detail, is in making it as specific as possible. And you want to, you know, we talked about, you mentioned how Gilroy would use biblical references. We don't see a lot of that nowadays. We don't see a lot of, you know, the classics, but we do see, you know, more popular culture references. You want the best cartoons are unmistakable. You look at them, and I can look at it, and you could look at it, and your callers could look at it, and we could see the same thing. Now, if you're getting to where we all, the five of us or 150 of us, look at things and get 150 different meanings, you have a bad cartoon or you have a bad piece of satire.
Hmm. Is there a worldview that cartoonists share? I'm asking you to generalize, I know, but...
Yeah, I guess there's this misperception that they're cynical or that they're negative, and I think in some ways they are, but I also think they're the most hopeful people in America, because they wouldn't be devoting all their hard work and sweat and toil to reform if they didn't want America to live up to its ideals. So I think the best cartoonists are really angry when we don't live up to our ideas, our ideals. Social criticism is most necessary when our elected officials are at their most cynical and craving, when they're showing a reckless disregard for our democracy, and that's when we need editorial cartoonists the most, and we really, really, really need them now.
Yeah. Talk with us about a cartoonist by the name of Ted Rall.
Ted Rall.
Rall, yeah.
Yeah, R-A-L-L.
Yeah.
He's one of those that really likes to blow up buildings. He's he really, you know, one of the things I love about editorial cartooning is that we live in a country that values our freedom of expression. And this is, you know, we have this great tradition and great pride in free expression, but, you know, probably the most extreme form of expression in traditional journalism is the editorial cartoon. And we really measure what the First Amendment means by how much leeway or how much of a leash we give it. Ted Rawls, one of these guys who takes the leash so far out, it just about snaps, and sometimes it does. Now, a cartoon in the book that I mentioned is he did a cartoon called Terror Widows. And what he did was, after September 11th, a number of widows who had lost loved ones in September 11th were on TV a lot. And some of them were making money. And Ted Rawl did a series of strips in one cartoon, poking fun of them, and really, you know, sort of really going after it and portraying them as manipulative and crass and greedy, and the cartoon caused an absolute uproar. A number of newspapers canceled it, and a number of commentators just lashed into Rawl. And in some ways, part of the problem was it wasn't a very good cartoon because, you know, it made it seem like all the widows or the widowers or widowers of people who died in 2000 in the terrorism acts were like that, and that wasn't true. And even if a few of them did try to manipulate the tragedy for some monetary gain, I think I would let that go. Generally, I'm going to run about any cartoon that I see. That was one, I think, as an editor that I'm not sure I would have run.
Yeah. But he wouldn't say he was sorry for it.
No, he wouldn't. No, he wouldn't. And his explanation probably wasn't very good either. I think part of it was he was under so much attack that he felt defensive, and he stood his ground, and I just don't think it was a very good cartoon.
Yeah.
It was, you know, it wasn't a very good cartoon because it was so open to misinterpretation. And I think that's probably one of the problems with editorial cartooning. To me, the problems with editorial cartooning are not the cartoons that maybe go too far. It's the cartoons that are so open to misinterpretation. And, you know, we talk about, like, who was it, F. Scott Fitzgerald, who said there are no second acts in America. Well, I don't think there are enough second drafts in editorial cartooning. If you look at a lot of editorial cartoons, they sort of say the same thing. And yet the ones who separate themselves from the pack are the ones who say something unique. And that takes hours and hours of thinking and working at it to do that. And I think too many cartoons settle for their first draft.
Yeah. I think there's a cartoon in the book that illustrates this, where you have a cartoonist sitting at his desk and he's surrounded by, you know, like reference works of editorial cartoon cliches.
Yeah, potty humor and all sorts. That's Jeff Danziger. And if you're looking for a cartoonist today who is at the top of his game, it's Jeff Danziger. And your listeners can call up his work. He's with the Tribune Media Syndicate, and he is just terrific.
Yeah. He's also, his work is also very craftsmanlike.
Yeah.
Which is something that I think also, sometimes I'm disappointed in some of the quality. You might have something to say, but the quality of the drawing or its execution somehow is not what it could be.
And that really is I think one of the problems. See, a cartoonist need to do a better job of selling themselves to editors, and they need and how can you expect editors to take cartoonists seriously if cartoonists aren't taking themselves seriously? And right, some of the cartoons are stick figures pretty much. The idea is better than the drawing. The idea is more important than the drawing. And some cartoonists really aren't very good artists, but they're great idea people. And then there are the cartoonists you mentioned, like Danziger, who's a very good cartoonist, and he's also a real sharp guy. I mean, he has a cartoon that's in my book that he shows two army soldiers who are sort of running for cover early in the Iraq War, and I think one of them saying to the other one, "This whole situation could give slapdash, dim-witted, politically inspired interventions a bad name."
Yeah.
And there are these great, I mean, cartoonists like a Clay Bennett, for instance, who's with the Christian Science Monitor, does his on the computer, and that's his beef. You know, he says that, you know, if I worked an hour or two on a cartoon, my first drafts are the same as all the other editorial cartoonists' first draft, but I don't want them to be. So sometimes it'll take me 8, 10, maybe 12 hours to do a single cartoon. He's the one who did the probably, I think, my favorite cartoon of the Clinton administration, where he has Bill Clinton's standing there and he's got an "I'm with stupid" T-shirt that's pointed straight down, and I think that cartoon really summarizes the Clinton administration.
It hit below the belt, didn't it?
Yeah, and his newspaper didn't run that.
I know. Now that some of you have a chapter on cartoons that weren't published, and there are many in there that are very good.
Yeah, I know. As I mentioned before, nobody. Nobody got to be editor by because of their sense of humor.
Hmm.
But I think that's a terrific cartoon.
Yeah.
I just don't see that it really, yeah, you're right, it's below the belt, but I, you know, Clinton deserved it.
I meant that tongue in cheek.
Yeah,
cuz it really, it just bingo, just mm-hmm. you know, pow.
And there's one in there on a cartoon that is that takes a shot at the tobacco companies.
And
If there's any group that's sort of, you know, you could pretty much say whatever you want to about it's the leaders of the tobacco companies who came before Congress and lied about whether the smoking was habit forming. And sometimes it depends on, I'm sure, on the day. There was a cartoonist in Milwaukee who's long retired, named Bill Sanders, and his wisdom, which is really a smart way of going about it's a great negotiation technique, where he would have an idea that he wasn't sure would sell. So he would think of one, but he would take a sketch that was more outrageous to his editor, and then he would scale back to the one he originally started with, and I think that's probably pretty smart.
Mm. Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I have a comment and a request for a comment, I guess. You mentioned Jeff Danziger, whom I think is one of the great heavy hitters in editorial cartooning today, and he's also a great draftsman, but he can't caricature for
right.
anything. His caricatures don't look like the people they're supposed to look like, which is too bad because he has a very hard-hitting commentator, and his drawing in every other respect is superior. My request for a comment is that the editorial cartoonists as a group have, over the last 3 or 4 years, declined in the number of full-time employed staff cartoonists at newspapers. There used to be a couple hundred who were full-time editorial cartoonists at newspapers. And now it's less than 100, and it's the number is rapidly diminishing. And I wonder if you had any comments on that. I'll hang up and listen.
No, I agree with both of your comments. One is, yeah, Danziger's not very good at drawing caricatures. Neither is Gary Trudeau with Doonesbury, who I think is maybe in the short list of the great editorial cartoonists in American history. I agree with you on Danziger wholeheartedly, and you're also absolutely right. And in the last generation, the number of editorial cartoonists have gone from, as your caller said, 200 to about 80, which means editorial cartoonists are quickly becoming endangered species, and they're certainly worth protecting. And there are a few reasons. One, in the last generation, the newspaper industry has really been foundering. And part of that is the corporatization. Now the corporations, the home offices of newspapers, expect newspapers to have a 25% profit margin every year, and that means laying people off. And I also think that kind of attitude, it might make some people obscenely rich, but it puts journalism and democracy at risk. If they would settle for 15-18%, it would make fewer people rich, but it would make journalism better, which is in the best interest of the country, and they could do that. If you're trying to bring people to newspapers, and we are a country that more and more seems to be visual, why not the editorial cartoonist? Why not the editorial cartoonist? Editors, I've never heard an editor say, well, we don't have an editorial cartoonist because our readers don't want one. I've never heard that. I've never heard that reason before. It's always, well, we'd like to, but we don't have the money. Well, get the money.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a pretty weak excuse. I think they don't want it because they don't like the phone calls. They don't like the heat that comes with cartoonists. But, you know, look at our society now. It's just because we have it in talk radio on the AM stations. I'm not sure I would agree with anything about the Limbaughs of the world, but they are successful, and it tells us that it's okay to express your point of view. People are going to come, mm-hmm. And I think that I think newspapers should not only hire a cartoonist, but they should put them on page one.
Hmm.
And I'd be amazed what that does for readership.
I wonder, as the book is out there more and it falls into the hands of journalists and editors, reporters and editors, if you won't be invited to press association meetings to talk about it, I think that would be wonderful.
So would I. Yeah. It'd be nice.
Yeah.
My son needs some new shoes. So that would be great.
There's a story here that you tell near the end of Drawn to Extremes about this last thing that we've been talking about here this afternoon, and that's the firing of Kirk Anderson from the St. Paul Pioneer Press because the paper failed to meet the 20% profit goal. Even though, the rest of the community and the country was in recession. And
it's just absolutely madness that I teach journalism and it's such, when journalism's at its best or even when it's not at its best, we always, our democracy depends on it. And, America's greatest contribution to the civilization is the Bill of Rights and the First Amendment, and the First Amendment is giving us the right of free expression, and you see that no better illustrated than in editorial cartoons, and I just think that not only are newspaper publishers bad business people, but I think they're bad journalists.
Hmm. Do you see the cartoon? The editorial cartoon, the political cartoon, moving from the pages of the newspaper to other media. Earlier you mentioned the Internet. Maybe you'd give us that website again for our listeners to check in and look at some of the cartoons that are out there. Could editorial cartooning come back, but it won't be in the pages of our newspaper, but it will be in somewhere else?
Yeah, I think so. I hope. The website is politicalcartoons.com, and the editor of the website is Daryl Cagle, Cagle. I think people thought, every so often we talk about the state of the art and the death of editorial cartooning. This is not the first time this has happened, and there was an essay written in 1954 about the death of editorial cartooning, and it happened so often. And In the 1960s, people thought that television might bring, might be the reason, the savior for editorial cartooning. That never happened, unless you're talking about The Simpsons, which is not quite the same. But then we talk about the Internet, but until newspapers can find a way to make money,
mm-hmm.
off the Internet, that's not going to happen. So I don't know. I still think that, I still believe in the newspapers, and I think editors are sort of in denial. I like the description of editors as the, You know, they think everything's okay, and they're sort of like the captain of the Titanic telling the passengers, "Don't worry, we're just stopping for ice." You know, they've got to, we've got to do something to save the newspaper industry, and I'm not sure that editorial cartooning can do it by themselves, but it can sure help, and it can sure help. I think it helps keep politicians maybe a little honest. Wouldn't that be a wonderful thing if that happened?
Yeah. Well, also, like what the cartoonist we mentioned earlier, Rawl, you know, he said, "Well, I don't think I can save the world, but, you know, I'll give it a try."
Yeah. You know, anybody who is so passionate about what they do, and I, you know, whether it's, you know, you or me or Ted Rawl or somebody playing the violin or somebody teaching or someone, you know, selling clothes, whatever it is, I don't see where the downside is. It makes us all better. Mm-hmm. And for these editorial cartoonists, every day to go to their drawing board and say, you know, what am I going to do today? And I mean, what upsets me today? And how can I express my outrage? I mean, someone once said about Jeff McNally, the Carter. Jeff McNally was one of the last really good conservative editorial cartoonists, and the Carter administration just hated him. And somebody in the Carter administration said that if McNally weren't a cartoonist, he'd be an assassin. So I'm not sure that's quite right, but it does get into the state of mind of the editorial cartoonist.
Yeah. We have to wrap up here, Chris.
Yeah.
Do you have a website, or you want to share an email address with us or anything?
Yeah, my email is LAMBC, which is LAMC, and then it's at cofc.edu. So it's my last name, the first initial, at, and an abbreviation for College of Charleston, so cfc.edu.
Okay, very good. And we'll put a link on our website, or the information on our website at wyll.uiuc.edu. Chris Lamb, thanks so much for joining us this
afternoon.
Thank
you, Celeste. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Chris Lamb is professor of communication at the College of Charleston. He is the author of Drawn to Extremes, The Use and Abuse of Editorial Cartoons. The book is published by Columbia University Press. 7 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. It was a very difficult day if you were a producer on the Chicago Board of Trade, where we saw double-digit losses both in the wheat and soybean pits. We saw late fund selling in the wheat pit that drove the March contract to the day's low by the close. We saw sliding in the corn pit as well, being pressured by the nearbys as well as the deferreds in the soybean pit. We saw new contract lows set across the board in corn. And then in the soybean pit, the January contract going off the board today at noon at 15.5 cents to the red side. We'll talk about the implications of today's trade at 2:06 with Mike Zuzulo of Risk Management Commodities on the closing market report. Let's go ahead and look at the current tick and the settlements for today. March wheat, a high of 307, a low of 297.25, settling 297.5 down 10. May, a high of 314, a low of 304.75, settling 305.25 down 10. July, a high of 321.5, a low of 311.5, settling 312.25 down 10.25. September, a high of 327, a low of 317, settling 318.25 down 9.75. December, a high of 333.5, a low of 325.5, settling 326 down 10 on the day. March corn, a high of 199.25, a low of 197. That's the new contract low for the contract, settling 197.25 down 2.75. May, a high of 206.5, a low of 204.5, settling 204.75 down 2.75. July, a high of 213.75, a low of 211.75, settling 212 down 2.75. September, a high of 221.25, a low of 219, settling signaling on the low down 3. December, a high of 230.5, a low of 228, settling 228.5 down 3. March corn, a high of 238, a low of 236.5, settling 236.5 on the low down 2.5 on the day. March oats, a high of 164.5, a low of 163, settling 164.25 unchanged. May, a high of 155.25, a low of 154.5, settling 155 down 1. January soybeans, the contract that went off the board at noon today, a high of 533.5, a low of 539, settling 542 down 15.5 on the day. And then if you look at that particular contract on a week-to-week basis, you see that it was down 9.75 from a week ago. March, a high of 531, a low of 519, settling 519.5 down 17. May, a high of 534, a low of 522, settling 522.75 down 16.25. July, a high of 540, a low of 528.5, settling 528.75 down 16. August, a high of 540, a low of 530.25, settling 530.75 down 15.25. September, a high of 538, a low of 531, settling on the low down 15. November, a high of 551, a low of 540, settling 541.25 down 15.25. January soybean meal, a high of 167.90, a low of 160.50, settling 162.80 down 4.90. March, a high of 161.20, a low of 154.50, settling 154.80 down 6.80. January soybean oil, a high of 19.78, a low of 19.65, settling 19.67 down 29. And March, a high of 19.95, a low of 19.60, settling 19.63 down 45 on the day. Settlement prices are also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And Celeste, I believe you do have those.
I do have those. January feeder cattle today, the high 106.15, the low 105.60, the settlement 105.85, that down 30. March 102.65, the high 101.85, the low 102.15, the settlement, that down 25. April $100.80, the high $100.10, the low $100.60, the settlement, that off 22.5. February live cattle 91.60, the high 90.65, the low 91.32.5, the settlement, that finished up 15. April 89.60, the high 88.70, the low 89.15, the settlement, that down 37.5. February lean hogs, the high 77, even the low 76.20, the settlement 76.77.5, that up 57.5. April 78.25, the high 77.35, the low 77.65, the settlement, that down 2.5. May 77.20, the high 76.65, the low 76.97.5, the settlement, that up 22.5. June lean hog 78.90, the high 78.05, the low 78.72.5, the settlement, that up 37.5.